This is episode 500, and I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening, for the support, the feedback, the messages, and the ideas. That's what motivates me. I started this journey because I had questions and I wanted answers about being a doctor in and out of the exam room. I started this soon after my second son was born, and a lot's happened since then. We've had a third son. We've been through a pandemic, covered a lot of material on that. We bought an Airbnb, so check out wolfhillacres.com. We launched the Doctor Podcast Network, for any of you all that want to have your own podcast. Rebranded the show as Succeed in Medicine, and I was recently elected to the board of my practice and invited to speak at my alma mater's Academic Day, Georgetown. Much of this would not have been possible without what I've learned from the podcast. So I hope you've grown with me, and I'm sure you have. And thank you for listening. Here's to another 500 episodes of growth and possibility to help us all succeed in medicine, however you define success. You've made a mistake that caused a patient harm. Now, that doesn't happen to other doctors. Your department chair would be ashamed. Maybe you shouldn't be a doctor anymore. Now, you know that's not true, and your other patients, that patient, they need you. So how do we reckon with mistakes in a career that demands perfection? Dr. Danielle Ofri is a primary care internist at Bellevue Hospital and a clinical professor of medicine at NYU, widely recognized as one of the foremost voices on the emotional realities of medical practice. She writes about medicine and the doctor-patient relationship for outlets like the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Lancet. Dr. Ofri is the founder and editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review, the first literary journal to emerge from a medical setting. She's the author of What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine, and When We Do Harm, A Doctor Confronts Medical Error, among many other books. Now, those two landmark books explore how clinicians live with uncertainty, mistakes, and the burden of harm. Through her writing, speaking, and clinical work, she brings humanity and nuance to how physicians reckon with adverse outcomes and mistakes while continuing to care for patients. First, a word from our sponsors. You're listening to Succeed in Medicine, the show for practicing physicians who want to master the parts of their career and life that med school never prepared us for. From interpersonal skills to career navigation to the essential information every physician needs. I'm Dr. Bradley Block, and in every episode, we bring you brass tacks advice and immediately applicable insights from world-class experts so you can feel prepared wherever your MD takes you and build a life in medicine that's sustainable, rewarding, and actually worth all those years of sacrifice. You've spent years making careful decisions with lasting impact. When it comes to investing, the same principle applies. Lightstone Direct gives you access to institutional quality real estate investments with decades of proven experience behind them. Invest directly, no middlemen, and a $12 billion-plus asset under management real estate firm in your corner. Remember, all investments involve risk. Please visit lightstonedirect.com for a full list of disclosures. Dr. Danielle Ofri, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you've written a lot about the emotional side of practicing medicine. And, you know, we're going to talk today about making mistakes, right? Nobody's perfect. To err is human, to quote that study. So can you take us back to a mistake or an adverse event that still lives with you today? And for the audience that is maybe cringing at that question, she writes about this, right? It's all in her book. So we're not opening up a wound that she hasn't spoken up about before. So yeah, so can you talk about a specific mistake that still lives with you today?
Well, how much time do you have? I got a lot of mistakes in the history. So I'll take you back to first month of PGY2. And I'm with my team. I intern my medical student and we get the classic Bellevue DKA. Someone's arrested. They're thrown in jail. They don't have their insulin. And, you know, within a couple hours, end up in DKA, end up at Bellevue. So we get this guy and he's in the emergency ward in the EW. And we're adjusting. I'm doing all this great education to my intern about how you handle DKA and our minute adjustments. I'm fabulous as a teacher. And we're ready to turn off the drip. And the nurse turns to me and says, do you want to give a shot of long-acting insulin before I turn off the drip? And I sense a teaching moment, turn to the intern and say, how do we want to do that? You know, after all of this meticulous fine-tuning, why would we want to bulldoze the guy with long-acting insulin and be there forever? And we put him right back in DKA. The intern nods sagely. I nod sagely, completely incorrectly. And we turn up the drip. And wouldn't you know, in a couple hours, he's back in DKA. And so med consult comes down. She looks at the numbers for like a second. She looks at me and says, what were you thinking? And I'm in the middle of the EW, you know, there's like trauma slots going on. And I'm standing there, like first turning red as a beet. My intern's right there. And she says to me again, what were you thinking? And I'm thinking, what was I thinking? Because of course, as you should all know, giving long-acting insulin is a thing you do before you turn off the insulin drip. Either I had forgotten it, I slept through in medical school, or who knows what, but I didn't do it. And I realized it right away. And I remember just like wanting to like just dissolve into the ground like the Wicked Witch of the West, but she would not let me get out of it. And she stood there yelling at me for an answer. And it was like I just like lost my bladder control in the middle of the EW. And of course, the slots are going by and nurses are yelling. And I remember being the most mortified in my life that I had made this horrific mistake in front of my intern so confidently. And it was precisely the wrong thing to do. And I have never forgotten what it felt like to be in the middle of that EW being screamed at by your senior for a mistake you knew was wrong and you had no reaction of what to say of why you did it.
So let's take that moment, right? Because that you were a trainee at the time, right? Like that's what training is for. And we do make significantly more mistakes when we're in training than when we're after training. But things still happen. Mistakes are still made even when we're attendings, right? So let's say a similar such mistake happened when you were an attending, right? Maybe not that, but you know, that because that will never happen, right? That's now
no,
a part
not.
Of your drink. Yes.
The 11th commandment, turn off the insulin drip, right? First of all, you know, I would put the onus a little bit on whoever is the senior person involved. So that person should not yell at the underling in the middle of a crowded room and humiliate them about their mistake. That will not serve any purpose. It will not make the patient better, will not make the intern or lower person remember any better. It just serves to mortify them and just paralyze them.
You're saying that mortification, what made it indelibly part of your memory, and now the 11th commandment. So isn't that an argument? I'm just playing devil's advocate. I'm not arguing for verbally lashing people.
Once you've made the mistake, you never forget it. I have never not done that. And I would have happened even without the mortification. Okay. But what the mortification served to do was for me to turn around and think, I'm in the wrong field. I had better quit right now before I kill anyone else. Let me go do a desk job with pharma or an insurance company. I am not cut out for clinical medicine. I'm just here to kill patients. So I better quit. And that's what the mortification served. So step one, if you are the senior in this position, the first thing you do is pull the person aside in private and ask, what happened? Or if it's an emergency, you take care of the patient first. Obviously, that's the first thing, make sure they're safe. But once you've gotten past that immediacy, you ask what happened and how it happened, because there's almost always a how. You don't typically make mistakes of saying choice A is right. I'm going to go do choice B. Like that is not what happened.
Let's see what happens.
So, you know, we were on call. There was no cap on admissions. We were juggling all kinds of patients in the EW. It was me 1 month out of internship and an intern 1 month out of medical school running around by ourselves handling all of this, which was just crazy. And yes, that was why, you know, and I somehow flipped something in my head and just got it wrong.
It made sense at the time. Yeah,
it made sense at the moment. I rationalized that and I was trying to be a good teacher and a good leader and I was flat out wrong. So I think, you know, there's a lot of things we could have done differently. Certainly my senior could have done, I could have done. But yeah, it put me close to quitting medicine. And when you're so junior in your career and your self-esteem is so fragile, so slender, you know, one or two slams from the higher-ups, you think, you know what? You're right. I am the imposter. I better quit now. And if you could imagine if every nurse or doctor who made a mistake when quit, well, that would be an adverse outcome for patients because there wouldn't be anyone left except the people who lie. Those would be the ones who are left.
Who probably have more mistakes then because that's their skill set. But let's say this mistake was made as an attending. You're an attending. You really should be practicing a higher level of medicine, making fewer mistakes. Let's say something like that happened and it does. Let's say you were a mentor to young you, right? What is the conversation that you would have. So not the initial conversation of what were you thinking? How did this happen? Right. Psychological safety so that the trainee feels like they're in a safe place to be able to disclose their thought process and get some real learning done. Right. That's all happened. But now you've got someone who's ruminating on this mistake they made. They're thinking, I don't deserve to be in medicine. How do you counsel young you in that situation?
Well, first of all, I go back to the moment and I see, you know, the old rule from House of God, the first step in a code, take your own pulse. And I do think, you know, physiology first, in that take your own pulse. Unless the patient's immediately crashing, you can probably take 20 seconds, 30 seconds to like take a deep breath, just yourself for a second. Because when you're in this fight or flight, you cannot think clearly, and you do owe it to yourself and to your patient to calm down the adrenaline a little bit. So take that. And then, of course, attend to the patient. We have to be sure the patient is okay. You know, that is the first thing. And maybe it's not the conversation with the patient about the error that may come later, but to make sure the patient's safety and health and medically is addressed. Then, you know, what are the things I need to do right now to fix it? What are these sort of immediate fixes? And maybe you need to delegate. Maybe you can't at that moment. And that's, I think, a very rational thing. If you are not in the position to do it, you can say to your colleague, senior, you know, someone, you know, I can't do this right now. You know, I'm too distraught, too, you know, in such a state that I don't think I can do right by my patient. Could you cover me for 20 minutes? And hopefully work in a system where people understand that people have their moments and that you shouldn't put on the bravado if you're not able to. Now, often we're able to, but to be able to say, hey, I need a minute, that's important. And then is there someone you can confide in that you trust? You know, a trusted colleague, you know, somebody in medicine who understands. I think, I mean, obviously you may want to tell a spouse or a friend, but you need to talk to someone in medicine. Maybe it's your colleague from residency who's not in your system. Here's what happened. You know, I want to figure out what I did, kind of walk through it, how I responded. And 99 chances out of 100, they're going to reassure you, you're not crazy. And in fact, I remember going to an M&M with a DKA mistake that an intern presented. And the chief of medicine, the first thing he said was, welcome to the DKA club, right? Because everyone screws up DKA at some point, right, in their training, if you're in medicine. And that's just the way it is. We all do. And that was so reassuring to hear. Oh, everyone, even the chief of medicine has mucked up DKA at some point. And so that's a really helpful way to do it. And then when you're calmer and you think, okay, how did this happen? What was in my circumstance that made this error more likely? Because so often there are reasons that swing the Bayesian probability toward error, right? Overwork, stress, poor resources, poor lighting, you haven't eaten lunch, and all these things add up, you know, sound alike medication names, all kinds of things. And when all those holes of the Swiss cheese line up, the patient falls down the hole. So thinking about those things and then recognizing the difference between making an error and being the error. You know, there are probably a couple of bad apples out there in medicine, but I think they're precious few. And those are the ones who end up in those big podcasts, Dr. Death kind of thing. Most people are trying their darndest to do their very best. And mistakes happen even to good and conscientious people, which is the vast majority of people in healthcare. And to recognize that you're still a good and competent and caring physician or nurse, and that errors do happen. And we work diligently to make them less often. We think about systems that make the errors more likely, you know, and talk to our admin about what in the EMR, you know, in our EMR, they just moved two tabs around, some kind of thing. And you know what? I keep pressing the wrong thing. That's a ridiculous thing, but it makes an error more likely because some developer in Epic decided to, oh, we'll do a little revamp, and now we're all pressing the wrong button.
Yeah. So there was something that you said earlier, and I think it answers one of my subsequent questions, which is, let's say you're a surgeon and you make a mistake in the operating room, right? And it's your first case of the day, and you've got a couple more cases that day, right? And I think your answer to that question, correct me if I'm wrong, is that you talk to someone about it. You talk to one of your colleagues. You talk to one of your mentors. You talk to the chair of your department. Say, listen, I was in the operating room. This is what happened. I've got two more cases today. And you can get a little counseling from them so they can, as you said with the DKA club, listen, something happened to me a couple of years ago. It was the same thing, you know, and so you can commiserate with and realize that you're not the horrible surgeon that at that moment you are thinking you are.
Right. And then you make a triage decision with your chair or mentor. Can I go through with the remaining cases? Am I in a state that's safe for the patient and me to continue operating? And it may be, yes, you can do that, or maybe not. And if it's not, to recognize that, because not recognizing that that's a crime for your patient, whether you've had a drink or you're in an emotional state or you're dealing with the death of someone in the family that's gotten you too distraught to operate. I mean, I think we owe it to our patients, you know, and to the system to be honest. So if it's personal, you don't have to tell the detail, but you can say to your superior, I can't operate for these reasons. I don't think it's safe. You can't do that every day, but the once a year that comes up, you know, then you're trusted to know that that's truly the case.
And I would imagine the same for the internist who has 20 patients on their schedule, and the second patient of the day, you learn that they got a terrible diagnosis that could have been made much sooner if you had ordered X, Y, or Z test. And now sure, you've got to sort of, yeah.
You didn't read the path report yourself and you missed something, which I've certainly had happen. There's lots of those things. One of the reasons I like working in an academic center where there's lots of people are in the old Bellevue building where a clinic was, we had something called the bowling alley. And that was a back hallway behind all the clinic rooms. And the front of the door went into the waiting room, but the back door went into the bowling alley. And if you had a question, you could pop out. There's always someone in the bowling alley. It stretched the entire length of the building. You could look down. Oh, there's someone, you know, 75 feet down. But there was someone there to talk to if you had a question. You didn't understand a lab result. You didn't know how to call radonc. Or you were feeling overwhelmed by the patient. Or the patient was aggressive. Or you had made an error. There's someone to talk to. So being in a setting, and I'll compare that I worked in a private practice, which was with a wonderful person, but we never saw each other. We were alone the whole time because we were so busy and it was a tiny practice. And I remember missing the community and camaraderie of being in a larger setting where there was at least someone you could always find at any given moment when you had a stressful moment. And that was so important for just going forward in the day because every day is stressful in medicine.
Hello there, Dr. Boss. You should consider doing a podcast or starting a YouTube channel. And if you're a doctor that already have a podcast, even a YouTube channel, you want to up level, well, we have just the thing for you. I'm Dr. Ann Traw.
I'm Dr. Mike Lorraine.
We're talking about Dr. Podcast, drpodcast.com. Mike and I are having an actual live event in Orlando, Florida. As a doctor, you need to start making money from your podcast or YouTube channel. We have a stellar lineup of speakers. And for me, it's really more collaborative. It's going to happen in January 15th of 2026. It's going to be lasting for 4 days. You have really two events. So your ticket not only cover the Dr. Podfest event, but it's also covering the whole 4 day event of Podfest Expo, where you learn everything about podcasting and being YouTube and even marketing. You never know where it's going to lead you once you get in front of a microphone, doctors, because all sorts of doors will open for you. Take a leap of faith and do something different. And you never know where that is going to lead you. Bring the kids, bring yourself, start something new for January.
Is there a difference between an error of omission and an error of commission when you're discussing this? Like, I forgot to order this test versus I cut this thing that shouldn't have been cut.
You know, I think that the commission makes us feel worse when you do something that causes an error. I gave this medicine that was wrong. I remember being as a medical student with a heme fellow, and he was about to give intrathecal chemotherapy. And there were two syringes on there. And he ended up picking up the wrong one by accident, realized it once it was injected. And the patient did terribly. The patient had a terrible prognosis to begin with, but they did terribly very quickly. And I think that for the rest of the years, I never saw that fellow's head up off the ground. It was in a permanent posture of head down. And I didn't know, but I imagined that they were so mortified by having done something. Now, of course, from the patient's perspective, that's no different than if you forgot to do something that led to a terrible outcome. But I think for we as physicians who like to do things, the doing of something, the misdose, the miscut, that it stings harder, but in actuality, it's the same outcome for the patient. So I think we should look at them similarly. Although when we counsel our colleagues and ourselves to recognize that the errors of commission, we just beat ourselves even harder on those.
So let's say you were in the position you are now, right? And that same fellow you crossed paths with, but that was years ago. So basically you're seen as a mentor. It's kind of the same question that I asked earlier. How would you counsel him having seen?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, if they want to talk about it, but I think to remind them that they're torment I witnessed that. Like, I bore witness to your torment. And this was a great fellow. I had seen this person around. They were dedicated. They cared. They showed up late. They showed up early. And that they are a fantastic physician. And their patients were so lucky to have someone of that amount of dedication. And yes, an error did happen, but he was not the error. And I would want to remind him of all the good he's done in the world, how many patients he walked through their cancers, and that he was really valued, and that he was not the mistake. He had made a mistake. It happens. Why wasn't there an assistant there? Because we're short-staffed. He should have had a nurse with him doing that, but he didn't. He had to do it on his own, like residents and fellows often do when they're in training. You know, we do it all on our own. And the system in the real world should have had a nurse who was checking the labels and handing off the syringes, but no, we did it on our own. Yeah. And the difference between making an error and being an error is very important to stress.
So I want to talk about that some more, but you said bearing witness. And that reminds me of another great physician author who's actually been on the show. He's got his own podcast now, Jonathan Winkle, who talks a lot about and wrote a book recently about religion in medicine and the parallels and how we should maybe have more religion in medicine and bearing witness. It just, that term, it just really resonated with me.
I mean, it strikes me because I think with our patients, a lot of times in healthcare today, most of our patients suffer from things we can't cure. Let's just say there are a few things, you know, you can take an appendix out, great. But most people have either chronic illnesses or conditions exacerbated by poverty, economic issues, immigration issues, stress at home, substance use, all these things that we know are creating problems for them, but we can't solve those things so easily. And it's frustrating, you know, as a clinician, when you can't solve something easily. But bearing witness to our patient's pain and suffering is so important, no matter what field we're in. Listening to the patient's story, and because you may be the only person that patient has opened up, whether it's the story of their domestic violence at home, the political torture they escaped in their country, the suffering of, you know, taking care of the grandchild because the child is incarcerated or has HIV, or all the things that happen that cause our patients to suffer, some of which are illnesses that we affect, but lots of things aren't, but impact their illnesses. And so they are relevant to medicine. And the bearing witness, the respectful and being there and being present, that is so powerful. In whatever field you are in, remember when your patients are suffering, they sometimes just need to share that with someone. And you may be that only person. And although we're rushed and busy, it is such an honor to be trusted with that patient's story, that they're suffering, they're giving you something. And it's really a moment of respect and honor that I think we sometimes forget about in medicine that we have. And it's an incredible power to use it respectfully and carefully and recognize that you do your patient an immense service. And many patients will walk out of your office or your room or the hospital room feeling better because you have patiently listened respectfully to their story of suffering.
And we can use that same paradigm for our colleagues that are suffering in that situation. We know they're excellent people, they're excellent doctors, they're very competent, but nobody is perfect. Mistakes happen, and patients, unfortunately, sometimes suffer for it. But it doesn't mean that colleague may have a career of patients that they could be helping. And we can do something to facilitate that.
Yes, we can. So I always think about we are each other's keeper, you know, that we need to keep our eyes open the same way our eyes are attuned to our patients, you know, for their physical exam, for physical signs and symptoms, for their history. We need to keep our eyes attuned in the same way to each other. You know, who is suffering? Who's struggling out there? It's important because A, we only have a limited number of doctors out there and we can't afford to lose anyone. But B, it's there, but for the grace of God or whomever, go I. You know, if you're not making a mistake today, if you haven't dropped a lung, putting a central line, you haven't put enough central lines, it's just the way it is. You haven't done enough medicine if you haven't made mistakes.
It's funny. We say the same thing about tonsil bleeds. If you don't have a tonsil bleed, you're not taking out enough tonsils. Yeah.
Exactly. So to do that and be there for that person, it may just something as small as, hey, looks like you're struggling there. You know, do you want to have a cup of coffee or do you want to talk for 5 minutes? Let me take your next case or let me take the next patient or take 15 minutes, I'll cover the ER, something like that. Those small things are so meaningful. If you think about when you've had your struggle, if someone lends the tiniest bit of a hand in some way, that recognition of your suffering and that you deserve a little bit of grace and that you are a good and competent, caring professional, because we don't go into this without reason to be taking care of patients. I mean, I think long gone are the days you went into it for the money. There's much easier ways to earn money in this world.
Especially at Bellevue, yeah.
And so really everyone, I'll say 99.9999%, people go into healthcare, go into it for the right reasons. And we just have to remind each other of that and how important it is that you are here. And if you weren't here, imagine how many patients would have a loss if you weren't there.
Amazing. So we were talking earlier about you made a mistake. You are not the mistake. And if I'm correct, that's the difference between guilt and shame.
Exactly.
So why is that distinction important?
There's a great book called On Apology, and it's written by Aaron Lazar. He was a dean at UMass, and he talked about the difference between guilt and shame, and that physicians have trouble distinguishing them. And so guilt is about the thing that occurred. Guilt prompts us to make changes, improve, do better next time, right? Guilt is, okay, I'm not going to forget to inject the long-acting insulin. Shame is about us. Shame is when, like, the person we saw that we thought we are not. And that image of us, it's like the mirror shattering. And that is just destructive to, you know, the inner core of the person. And guilt makes you want to make things better. Shame makes you want to go hide under a rock and just weep. And again, if we all ended up under the rocks weeping, we'd have no healthcare system. And so we have to help ourselves and our colleagues distinguish between guilt and shame. And guilt in the right dose, and if appropriately apportioned, makes sense. Shame almost never serves a productive purpose. And so when we are pointing out errors, particularly to those beneath us in the hierarchy, to be careful that we're not shaming them, but helping them see what happened, how to handle their guilt in a productive way, in a constructive way. But shaming just really doesn't get us anywhere.
So how do we balance, like, well, this is a systems problem, this isn't my fault, and then shirking the responsibility versus feeling the crush of shame?
Okay, let's look at all the elements in this error. And some things are systems errors, some are our, you know, short-sightedness, and some are genuinely things we did wrong. I ordered X instead of Y. I did this instead of that. That was a mistake. And then I can look and did I not know it? Was a lack of knowledge? Was I too lazy to look it up? Was I too rushed to look it up? Those are two very different things. If you're too rushed to look it up, there's a systems issue. If I was too lazy and I just kind of went off the top of my head, that's an internal issue. And so probing honestly into how those things happen is really important. And if someone's just sort of blaming everything on the system without looking honestly at their own role, because our name is at the top of the chart. And so it is important to be honest. And I think that's a little bit like if you ever do therapy. Therapy only works, psychotherapy, if you look honestly at yourself. If you just sort of do bromides and, you know, skim the surface, you'll get nowhere. You know, it's like you won't get anywhere in the gym if you just pretend to work out. You have to actually lift the weight. And when we look into ourselves, when we introspectively for the errors we've made or other issues like that, we have to lift the weight and be honest. It's very hard to do, you know, and I think a lot of people get a little bit cocky in medicine. We kind of select for accomplished and cocky people. It's hard to look at your own mistakes. It's very hard to look at your flaws. And it takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to do so. And a good therapist can really help. So don't be shy about getting a therapist. I think anyone who starts medical school should be assigned a therapist on day one, just to be at the ready, because everyone will need one at some point and probably on call throughout our career. You know, the things that we do are different than most occupations. And I think it's important that we be introspective.
Yeah. I mean, we are perfectionists. We are prone to anxiety, like high achievers. Like the Venn diagram of those things is a circle, right? And then you throw the responsibility of taking care of people and the expectations we put on ourselves to not make any mistakes. And we don't talk about those mistakes either.
I know. Because we're ashamed.
Yes. And then we just assume nobody else is making the mistakes because nobody's talking about them.
And it's really two sides of the same coin. I mean, being a perfectionist, you know, we want to be really thorough. And that's a really great skill in medicine to like every single thing, every box has to be checked before I leave for the day. And that's a skill you want. But on the flip side, you know, then we can tear ourselves out for these small things that happen. Or even with big things, our reaction is often way overdetermined compared to what the thing really is.
So we're running out of time. But before we close, I want to talk about the conversation that we can have with a family or the patient when we make a mistake and how therapeutic can be. Now, I do want the listeners to keep in mind, this is not a legal conversation we're having because the legal ramifications of it really are state to state. Because we had an episode about this a couple of years ago, where there are some states, if you apologize, it's an admission of guilt. And right. not guilt, but you know what they say in malpractice. Yeah. But the therapeutic value of maintaining that relationship and being upfront and having a conversation about it.
Well, I will just say there was a study from a couple of years ago that had looked at, and then this I think it was a simulation, but you know, when an error happens, if the doctor tells you or doesn't tell you kind of upfront, are you more or less likely to fire the doctor? And people were much less likely to fire the doctor if they came forward and told them the error proactively, because then they said, well, now I know I can trust them. If they find out later there's an error that you didn't tell them, that really breaches the trust. I mean, obviously, because the legal part does mix in here, the first step is always to go to your supervisor and they can direct the show, talk to risk management. What are the things we need to do, you know, on the legal side of things? But at some point, you do need to talk with the family and the patient. And you should tell them what happened, you know, why it happened. Patients are remarkably understanding. I mean, of course, they can be really angry, no doubt about it. But they know that errors happen. And in fact, they're paranoid that errors are happening all the time and that no one's telling them. And so if you're the first person who says, hey, this didn't go quite the way we had planned, you know, and here was my role in that. These are not the easiest. They're the hardest conversations to have. But when I've done them, the patient for whom I missed the pulmonary embolus, right? That's like a classic disaster. Oh my God. And they were understanding of that. I explained why I checked in on them. It's really important because what patients want most of all is to feel sort of made whole again. And they also want to know what you're doing to prevent that in the future. That's a big part. And when I wrote the book, you know, When We Do Harm, when I spoke to patients, preventing that in the future was, I think, the largest thing in their mind. You know, you can't take away what happened, but you can make the system better. And patients really want to do that. What are you doing to change it in your facility? Is there a new system in place, a new lecture series in place? I don't know, new checks and balances, whatever it is. And they're very much focused on that. And I think the root of lawsuits mostly is this lack of trust, feeling that you were lied to. And study after study of malpractice suits almost always boils down to a communication error. And, you know, before the When We Do Harm, I wrote this book, What Doctors Say What Patients Feel About Communication and Miscommunication. The medical error book almost felt like the same book in some ways, because almost every error is a communication error. Yes, you know, you can grab the wrong syringe, you know, in a minute of rope. But if you boil down most, I don't know, I can't give you a number, but more than half the errors, they can come down to some kind of communication error. And which is really fascinating. We think about how to prevent error. You know, we think a lot about checklists, but we forget to really think about communication with the patients, with the nurses, with each other. So many areas of places for possible error. But patients feel like they're being blindsided a lot of the times. And they sue because no one's being straightforward with them.
But let's say the outcome was some devastating injury,
right,
where it was irreparable harm to a family member, patient themselves. Let's say they lost vision in one of their eyes. Now they're blind in one eye because of a mistake that you made, right? Like, how do you have that conversation?
It is very hard. Now, again, rarely is it solely because of the single thing that you did, right? Yeah. It might be, but almost every error, even those kind of errors, there's a set of things in place that kind of coincided for that. So it's helpful to set the stage for the patient, not to be deflecting things, but I can hardly think of an error that is so pure of just that one doctor did A instead of B. It's almost never that.
Yeah.
When it is, we have to own up and the patients have a suit. Yeah. But I think we can give more of the context. I remember a case where they had some kind of restitution, you know, but the doctor themselves didn't show up. And the patient was so devastated that they wanted the doctor to come to them and say, I am so sorry that I did this and this happened to you. Not just that this happened, but that I did this.
Yeah. Not the passive voice. Gotta be the active voice.
Yeah. And then that's what Aaron Lazar talks about, pseudo-apologies. I regret if my actions caused this. You know, the typical politician's apology, that's not an apology, right? Yeah. That's a pseudo-apology. And the real apology acknowledges what happened, my role, my feeling about that. That is really important. I mean, think about, you see the doctor who's so smug, oh, nothing happened at all, versus someone who really feels
it. Yeah.
Right. It was the nurse.
I am so sorry. I feel, I've been up all night the last week thinking about this. I've been thinking about you. I've been worrying about you.
And I wish there were a way I could fix this, that it would be my deepest wish. And I will carry this with me. Like, you as a patient are staying with me because of this. It's not a passing ship in the night. This is so significant that I will carry this. It will impact my practice. I will change how I do X, Y, and Z. Because of this, you will be with me in my head the next time I'm in the OR. And every time in the OR, I will be thinking about you and how not to have this happen to anyone else. That's a genuine apology with, you know, this is the recourse that you're offering. You can't do a miracle. You can't rewind the tape, right? It's not ER or the pit. It happened. But you can be remorseful and you can talk about what the meaning is for you and the system.
You know, I thought it would be a little much to ask you for a script. Being a prolific author like yourself, that just came out so beautifully that, I mean, it shouldn't be scripted. However, it can be such an overwhelming conversation, the idea behind it to have, that to be able to listen to this again before you have one of these conversations, to be able to rely on some of those notes, I would take a lot of the angst out of it because you just said it so eloquently that
I think
it would be useful.
But also, I think if you talk with your supervisor who's probably done this before, and if they're a good and thoughtful
clinician. I don't know. I don't know how often this really happens in medicine where people are having such frank conversations about this. Like, we're all so terrified that this is going to be an admission of guilt and it's going to be used against us, which, again, varies from state to state. So you can talk to your legal department about it. It's been a long time since I've had a supervisor, so I don't know.
Right. Or find a mentor. I mean, we have mentors, we're not supervisors. You know, who are the mentors? You know, when you look around in the clinical world, who's the person you want to be at the next stage of your career as a physician? I mean, we're always growing. Yeah. And everyone in medicine is smart. We all come in smart and we're smarter with our devices and that. But being wise is a different thing. And wisdom is what is accrued over those years of being a physician. And so we're all on that sort of path of developing our wisdom. And so looking ahead, who are the people that you look to as wise clinicians? And they may be not even in your field, you know, but there's a wisdom. You see how they interact when they're doing their field of medicine. And that's the person that you turn to. And you, even if you don't know them, you say, hey, you know, I've seen you in the hospital. Could I get your counsel on something? And most people are incredibly honored to be asked that. So don't be afraid to look a little bit wider for the mentor, the person you would like to be, the wisdom that you emulate. Because, you know, when you think about, all right, half of what we do in medicine could be done by ChatGPT, right? It's not that hard, right? But, you know, if we think about when we're sick or our family is sick, we're looking for that wise doctor, right? Not just the good one, the smart one, but we want the wise one who knows not just what to do, but how and when and whether to do it and to what degree. That's the wisdom. And that's what I think we offer over ChatGPT. And I hope that we will continue to be valued for that. When I look for a doctor, I don't need the best technician. I mean, maybe for some things, but I want the person with the wisdom. And that's who I look to when I need to turn to with a tragic issue like that. I look for that person. Sometimes they're in palliative care or in psychiatry, but who really, you know, think deeply and not in a rush. Those are the people you should look toward.
Yeah. Well, you said the best technician. So a plug for next week's episodes, we're going to be talking about autonomous surgery, but they haven't taken that over yet. Well, Dr. Danielle Ofri, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom that you've shared with us here and through your literature, through your books, and just incredible. This has been such an amazing conversation. So if the listeners want to learn more about you, they want to read your books, where do we find you?
DanielleOfri.com is my website where I keep all my articles. And then I'll also mention Bellevue Literary Review. So my side hustle, as my teenagers call it, is I edit a literary journal and we publish fiction, poetry, and nonfiction about health, illness, and healing. And that's a place, an area where people grapple with some of these complicated issues using creativity. And sometimes we talk about fiction, the great lie that tells the truth, sometimes where we find the answers.
Amazing. Well, Danielle Ofri, thank you so much for your time and all you do for your patients and for us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means either you fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please write us a 5-star review, take a screenshot, and email it to me so I can send you a quick guide on how to earn patient trust in 20 seconds or less. Email me at brad@physiciansguidetodoctoring.com and feel free to suggest a topic or guest. I take your requests seriously. The views expressed on this episode are those of the interviewer and the interviewee and do not represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting makes it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or legal advice or really any advice. Thanks again for listening to Succeed in Medicine.